ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Australia and Indonesia announce an unexpected security treaty. Also, food delivery service Menulog shutting down, leaving thousands of workers out of a job. And a Melbourne hospital slashing waiting times for Indigenous patients.
Really encouragingly, for several weeks now, there's been no difference in the waiting times for our First Nations patients, which is really amazing to see our work in action.
Australia and Indonesia have this afternoon announced the signing of a surprise security treaty between the two nations. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, said the development signalled a new era as he made the announcement with the President of Indonesia, Prabowo Subianto, in Sydney. The ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts, was there. Stephen, did anyone see this treaty coming?
Look, the short answer, Sam, is no. There were murmurs about a week ago when the news of Prabowo Subianto's potential trip to Australia first started to bubble up. There were hints at the time that maybe there would be a significant announcement, but officials and staffers alike were all resolutely tight-lipped about what that announcement might be. Beyond suggesting it might have strategic implications. So in a sense, this really has come largely out of the blue. Now, it's been known for a while that Australia has been intent on closer strategic relations with Indonesia. It's always run against a bit of a brick wall, which is basically Indonesia's long-standing commitment to non-alignment and its appetite to cultivate multiple partners. And so what seems to have happened is that Australia has taken advantage of a new administration with Prabowo Subianto, with an appetite perhaps for slightly different arrangements, to negotiate this new agreement in what's basically total secrecy. The first formal announcement emerging only when negotiations were, we're told, substantively concluded by Mr. Albanese and Prabowo Subianto on the deck of the HMAS Canberra in Sydney this afternoon. So Australian officials have done pretty well not just to negotiate this, but also to keep it so effectively under wraps.
And Stephen, what are the terms of the treaty?
We haven't seen the full text yet, and whilst this is no doubt a significant development, judging the full weight and impact of this will take a little bit more time, and I think it'll be important to see the final version of the text ahead of ratification, and or signature, and then ratification. Nonetheless, the things that Anthony Albanese said about it seem to indicate that it could be quite significant. He says that Australia and Indonesia will consult at a leader and ministerial level on matters of security, look to undertake mutually beneficial security activities, and perhaps most importantly, if either or both countries' security is threatened, they will agree to consult and consider what measures may be taken, either individually or jointly, to deal with those threats. Now, that's Mr. Albanese's characterization of what's been agreed. Also, another interesting line saying that it's substantively based or very similar to the language in the landmark 95 agreement that Paul Keating and President Suharto signed. That agreement lasted only for a few years before being ripped up by Indonesia in the wake of the East Timor crisis. If all those things are true, and if it is in many ways similar to that 95 agreement, then this could be a very significant moment indeed for the relationship.
Stephen, what do you think China is likely to make of this announcement?
Look, difficult to say, and I imagine they will be also taking a very close look at the actual text of this agreement before jumping to any conclusions. The situation with China and Indonesia is, of course, radically different to the situation with China in the Pacific. In the Pacific, Australia is doing everything possible to try and lock China out from the security sector. In a country like Indonesia, vastly bigger, vastly more populous and more powerful, powerful and with a long history of non-alignment, locking out China is not a realistic aim, and nor, I imagine, would it be the aim of this agreement. Still, the fact that you have these commitments, at least according to the Prime Minister, to consult with one another in a potential crisis does represent a potential step change in the relationship and says something quite important about where the relationship is going.
Stephen Jedgetts is the ABC's foreign affairs reporter. Well, the Liberal Party looks set to dump its policy on net zero emissions, with reports more MPs are joining the chorus against the long-held policy position. The party has been debating the issue behind closed doors in Canberra today. The Libs were forced into a hurried decision-making process by its coalition partner, the Nationals. It decided to dump its net zero policy 10 days ago. The Liberal Party's conservative voices say they support reducing emissions in principle, but believe setting a target damages the economy, while moderate Liberal MPs are warning younger voters won't support a party that rejects a net zero platform. Rachel Mealy has more.
It's playing out a little like a duel between the Montagues and the Capulets. At noon in Canberra, the Liberal Party's moderates and conservatives faced off in the Liberal Party room.
Good morning.
The Conservatives, who'd like to see the net zero by 2050 target abandoned, presented a united front and walked into the meeting room together. In the front row of that group, Angus Taylor, Sarah Henderson and Andrew Hastie smiled at the waiting cameras in a show of force. Moderate voices in the Liberal Party entered in smaller groups or one at a time. Tasmanian Senator Richard Colbeck, also a moderate, made his own statement. He was holding a report called Winning Back the Coalition's Missing Middle. Earlier, Richard Colbeck again emphasised the importance of the Liberal Party winning votes.
The day will bring what it brings, but hopefully it's one that resonates with the Australian people, because as a party of government, that's what we need to do.
Senator Andrew Bragg has previously said he'd step down from shadow cabinet if the net zero commitment was ditched. Before he entered the meeting, he sounded a note of optimism.
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting with my colleagues. I think it's a great process that we get to discuss policy issues. And looking forward to hearing what the colleagues have to say.
What if they walk away today abandoning net zero entirely?
Well, I think we'll have a good discussion today. I'm not worried about people putting fatwas on words. I'm not worried about people trying to issue dictates. That's not a very liberal approach. So I think there's a lot of goodwill in our party to try and find a middle ground, and look forward to hearing what the colleagues have to say.
Melissa McIntosh is the member for Lindsay in Western Sydney. Speaking earlier in the day, she said she planned to tell her colleagues that ordinary people in her electorate want to see the net zero commitment abolished to ease the cost of living.
There are multiple components to where we are right now, but one of them that we can have a say in and we can do something about is resetting our energy policy and not being fixated on two words, net zero, and having a pressure on Australians to get us there.
Tony Barry is a former Liberal strategist and now pollster for Redbridge. He says voters associate the term net zero with credible climate action.
So there is room for debate, but often in politics it's how you say it, not always what you say. And I think the challenge for the coalition will be the tone and how they say it and who they use as the messengers. Now, for the last 10 years, they've effectively branded themselves as climate deniers, fairly or unfairly. That is how the electorate sees them. In all the focus groups we do, that is the overwhelming sense from most voters. So unless they can get that tone right and get the right people out there with the message, I cannot see any joy for the coalition on this issue.
Former Liberal Party strategist turned pollster Tony Barry. That report from Rachel Mealy. India and Afghanistan are denying Pakistan's accusations that they were behind a suicide bombing in the country's capital, Islamabad. 12 people were killed and dozens more injured in the attack. The bombing came only a day after a car explosion in India's capital killed 13 people. The ABC's Asia editor, Karishma Vyas, is in New Delhi. Karishma, what are the investigations revealing about this suicide bombing attack in Islamabad?
Well, the suicide attack, almost immediately after it occurred, the Pakistani government were quick to accuse Pakistani Taliban of carrying this out. And they were very quick to also implicate the Taliban government in Afghanistan, who they say is providing safe harbour for these militants who've been carrying out a series of attacks on Pakistani soil this year. They also said that India has been providing support to these militant groups. Now, both Afghanistan as well as India have been very quick to deny any involvement. In fact, the Indian government released a statement saying that they unequivocally reject the baseless and unfounded allegations. That's a quote from their statement. And they also accused the Pakistani leadership of being delirious. However, the government of Pakistan have vowed to retaliate if the Afghan authorities are unable or unprepared to rein in the militant activity from their soil.
And Krishma, how did the attack actually unfold?
Yeah, we've seen some really horrific pictures of a car that was trying to enter the compound of a local district court in Islamabad. And that car was then detonated when it wasn't able to get in to the compound. There was just chaos at the scene, smoke billowing from this vehicle, and more than 10 people were killed. It is significant because it's the first attack on a civilian target in the capital of Pakistan in more than a decade. Separately, we also saw an attack on a military school. This was much further out of Islamabad. It occurred along the border with Afghanistan, and three people at least were confirmed killed, and hundreds of students were trapped inside that school, which was a military school, when that attack occurred.
And as I mentioned, Karishma, there was a car explosion in India's capital, New Delhi, a day or so ago. 13 people were killed there. What's the latest on the investigation of that explosion?
It's been kept under tight kind of wrap in terms of the information that they're releasing. We're being very careful to call this a blast because the Indian authorities have not called it a terrorist attack. However, police have invoked an anti-terrorism law in their investigation of this. There's not much beyond that that authorities are releasing. Again, the Indian government being very careful not to point the finger at anybody specifically, but the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has vowed to hold those responsible to justice. And they said that they will be carrying out their forensic investigations and releasing the results when they're ready.
So, Karishma, what do these two blasts in India and Pakistan mean in terms of regional tensions?
Well, they indicate a realignment of partnerships and alliances between Pakistan, Afghanistan, and India. In the lead up to this week's events, we had a senior delegation of the Taliban from Afghanistan visiting India to shore up and deepen their ties with the country. At the same time, Pakistan has seen an increase in militant activity on their soil, which they point to groups that are basing themselves in Afghanistan. In fact, they conducted an airstrike in the heart of the Afghan capital, Kabul, not too long ago, they say, to target leaders within the Pakistani Taliban. And so you have a situation where Pakistan feels the pressure from its neighbours, Afghanistan and India, who are deepening their ties, and they feel increasingly alienated and their security under threat. So you're seeing a shifting of alliances, and this could have ramifications for the stability in this region. We'll see in the weeks and days to come whether the governments escalate this further or whether they find a path towards de-escalation.
Karishma Vyas is the ABC's Asia editor. She was speaking to me from New Delhi. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, a Melbourne hospital's successful plan to speed up the treatment of Indigenous patients. Thousands of food delivery riders and drivers are set to lose work after the digital platform Menulog announced it's shutting down. The business competes against food delivery giants like Uber Eats and DoorDash. While not giving a clear explanation, the company says it's been forced into a difficult decision to end its operations in Australia in a couple of weeks' time. Analysts say Menulog's demise can partly be blamed on the industry's lack of regulation. Diana Damjanovic prepared this report. Did somebody
say Menulog? With a catchy and constant flow of advertising packed with big-name celebrities, Menulog has become a known brand. Tacos to the chateau, please. But now it's fallen apart. For some Australians, delivering for digital platforms has provided crucial income. Michelle lives on the Mornington Peninsula, south of Melbourne, and has been delivering for Menulog for 4 years.
It's going to be very tricky for me now. I don't know what I'm going to do now. It's just annoying as well that it's before Christmas. That's going to be even harder.
She earns between $250 to $500 a week working for Menulog. It supplements a disability payment she receives, and she's not sure how she's going to cover the sudden loss.
It's probably going to impact a lot. I live in a rental at the moment. My oldest daughter is about to move out of home as well. She currently helps pay for the rent, so when she moves out, my disability won't cover all of the rent. So I won't know what to do after that bit. So it's going to financially impact me a lot.
While delivering fast food isn't what most people choose to do, Michelle says it was a good fit for her.
I didn't mind working for them because I couldn't set my own hours. I have a lot of health issues and so does my daughter. So it's easier for me to work for a company that I can do that. So I can literally cancel a shift 5 minutes before if something comes up, whereas I can't do that in a real situation working for other employers.
Like all other Menulog contractors, the first she heard about Menulog's impending closure was in an email this morning. Adjunct Associate Professor Graham Hughes is a retail and consumer expert at Griffith University. He says Menulog as a company was under pressure.
It's been a very competitive landscape. We've essentially had two major internationally backed players in Uber Eats and DoorDash, and it's a bit of a race to the bottom where they've been giving consumers very low prices in terms of their delivery rates, and it's really put a squeeze on the entire market.
That race to the bottom put a strain on the money workers are able to earn. Menulog says about 120 employees are affected and there are redundancy packages available. But the reality is many more low-income workers will be affected. Michael Kane is the National Secretary of the Transport Workers Union.
We've got thousands and thousands of workers relying on the income from the Menulog app, and we're going to put our shoulders to the wheel with the company to make sure they get what they're owed and an exit payment, and to see what we can do to transition them to other operations.
From its pioneering and innovative beginnings 2 decades ago, Menulog has been in rapid decline. Graham Hughes says just 3 years ago, its market share in Australia was about 30%, but that's dropped to 10%. And Menulog's end means the big players like Uber Eats and DoorDash will have more control of the market.
We've got essentially a duopoly, so we've got two major players. So for the restaurateur, the cafes, the many hidden eatery, which don't have a bricks and mortar store, they've got less options in terms of who to turn to for their delivery partner, which means that they've got a larger control on how much they're going to charge.
Graham Hughes says the withdrawal of Menulog echoes the loss of another food delivery company a few years ago.
This news obviously mirrors that of Deliveroo's decision to leave the market back in 2022. So it's very difficult landscape when you're up against the big behemoths, the international players who have very, very deep pockets and can have extended stays at the low delivery costs.
Michael Kane says Menulog is the latest victim of a highly unregulated market.
I think we've lost a player today that had very good intentions. a player that was unfortunately ravaged by a market that's out of control, downward spiral of standards and massive competition, but a player that had good intentions, and that's a shame. And we want to make sure that in the future, it's not just left to the intentions of the company, but there are enforceable standards in place that every company must abide by, so that we stop this downward spiral and indeed start building an upward spiral of standards.
Michael Caine says there's a need for change.
You know, we've all become really accustomed to pressing that button on our app, and as if by magic, there's a knock at the door and our food is there. We want that convenience, but I think most Australians also want to ensure that there's a stable market, that the worker that's delivering their food is properly looked after, has a minimum wage and can make a living for themselves and their families.
Michael Caine is the National Secretary of the Transport Workers Union, Diana Damjanovic, with that report. Peak medical bodies are backing a Melbourne hospital that's helping to close the gap in waiting times between Indigenous and non-Indigenous patients. The hospital has introduced a new approach aiming to assess and start treating First Nations people within half an hour of their arrival at the facility. Stephanie Bolci from the ABC's Indigenous Affairs team reports from St Vincent's.
You're okay. No one likes to wait in an emergency department, and sometimes it can result in serious consequences if that wait drags on. That's front of mind for Dr. Jonty Caro at St Vincent's Hospital in Melbourne.
We've done a lot of work to care for our First Nations patients, and we do a lot of data analysis around many different patient groups. And what we realised was is that our First Nations patients were waiting 2 to 3 times as long for care in certain triage categories, and also weren't waiting for care 3 times more often than non-First Nations patients.
So for over a year, this hospital has aimed to initially treat all First Nations patients within a half an hour.
And really encouragingly, for several weeks now, there's been no difference in the waiting times for our First Nations patients, which is really amazing to see our work in action.
The Victorian government supports the policy, which it describes as part of efforts to close the gap. But the state's opposition says the triaging of patients should be based on medical need, not based on race.
So I want to be absolutely clear that our non-First Nations patients haven't waited any longer to receive their care. We look at the data frequently. We want to provide equity of care for everyone, so everyone gets the care they need or want when they need it.
Nationally, Indigenous people have a higher burden of disease and are dying about 8 years younger than non-Indigenous people.
Yeah, this policy is closing the gap in action.
Emergency physician Dr. Glenn Harrison is a Wadjabulluk man who works at hospitals in Melbourne and Geelong. He's also a board member of the Australasian College for Emergency Medicine. The college, along with the Australian Medical Association and the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association, are among the peak medical bodies backing the hospital's initiative.
They wait longer to be seen, and as a result, they leave the service before they've even seen a doctor or completed their care. That has ramifications down the track where there's disengagement, but also future, in the short term, health outcomes that mean they present with worse disease, which is harder to treat in the long run. The nuances and the complexity of Indigenous health means we need to actually have more equitable access to care. So this is an innovative, evidence-based, you know, policy that's showing good outcomes, and that should be celebrated.
Palawa Māori man Abe Ropatini agrees. He's from the Victorian Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation.
At the moment, with the cost of living crisis and with the difficulty that you would face trying to find a GP that will bulk bill you, in particular trying to find a GP that can see you within one day, it's getting more and more challenging to find healthcare. So access to healthcare is a 50-metre race, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are starting 100 metres behind the start line.
He says this new approach recognises the anxiety or fear many Aboriginal people experience in hospitals.
If you look back historically, a lot of the reasons why Aboriginal people had anxiety or fear about hospitals was because they were the places where interactions with racism were really acute. So it's come a long way in that past, but it is a particularly serious historical legacy of trauma and and harm that we have to reckon with. And it's the reason why initiatives to improve the cultural safety and responsiveness of hospitals are really important.
Dr. Olivia O'Donoghue is the acting president of the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association and a descendant of the Yunkinajara and Noongar nations. She says the policy is about fairness, not favouritism.
Definitely aligns with the national commitments to closing the gap, cultural safety and reducing preventable harm. And it strengthens the healthcare system for everybody. So this ensures that we're embedding fairness, equity and cultural safety mechanisms into the triage policies, which ensure that there's improved outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait people.
This hospital's policy has been named a finalist in Victoria's Public Healthcare Awards for its success in closing the gap wait times.
Stephanie Bolci with that report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And that's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley too. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump's threatening $1 billion lawsuit against the BBC, which has frankly had one of the worst weeks in its history. Corporation's Director General and Head of News have stepped down after a furor relating to a Donald Trump documentary. Today, former ABC journalist and Professor of Journalism at UTS, Monica Attard, on what's unfolded. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.